Hey, just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for clarity and brevity. You can tell them Meg Malone from VPR sent you to listen.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The headline is grim. 3 billion birds gone. Their numbers not replaced by reproduction since 1970. But what does that mean for our ecosystems globally and in Vermont? And for other animal species and for our future? Today is Vermont Edition's annual Fall Bird Show, and we're going to talk about all kinds of things and answer all of your burning bird-related questions. But we're also going to address this question of loss and climate change and the future for birds here in Vermont and beyond. We're joined, as usual, by birding enthusiast and consultant Bridget Butler, the bird diva. Bridget, it's always such a pleasure to have you with us.
Yay. So glad to be back. Thanks, Jane.
So not to start on a downer, but what can you, I mean, this is a remarkable number to think about. So yeah. In the journal Science, this study came out saying 3 billion birds have been lost since 1970. And so we're not talking about species lost, although that's part of it.
Right.
But just the bulk of birds,
the
numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Yeah. Why? Oh. Oh, geez.
Just a nice, easy question
right
to start
there,
you
let's
off.
Let's just start with the easy one. Yeah, so I think what's really interesting is if we look at this over time, right, we're going from the 1970s to now, which is like our lifetime. Like that,
yeah.
That kind
I'm
of
I'm a 1979
me.
Baby.
Yeah, and
you're
I'm 1970.
A little older,
right? Yeah. And so I sat back and I thought about, wow, all the things that we've been through since, you know, the 70s and 80s, I think of some of the great legislation that came into play with the Endangered Species Act and like water quality things that came into play and stopping some of the pollution, both air and water pollution that was happening. And I think some of those precipitous declines that we saw in that first part of this kind of summary study were, you know, because of those things. And we took action, right? And so we saw everything kind of slow down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And now all these other, there's these other little nuanced things that are kind of coming into play. And for me, when I take...
Wait, nuanced and not so nuanced,
yeah,
right? Like
right.
Climate change,
like
not
climate
so nuanced.
Change isn't, but that's huge, right? And then we got to like kind of chunk it down into smaller mm-hmm. things that we can really understand. I think for me, when I really step back and kind of zoom out from this... the biggest thing to me is really habitat loss and the shift of how people are on the landscape and existing on the landscape and how that's impacting not only birds, but other animals as well. And I think climate change is a big part of that, right? We think about taking away forests and different things like that that are affecting the climate and putting other things into the air as well that are still affecting the climate. It kind of all ties together.
In Vermont... are we seeing bird numbers decline? I mean, that 3 billion number is a global number, but of course it's different from place to place.
Yeah, so that 3 billion number is actually based on data for North America and Canada.
Even worse.
Okay, so that's a little bit harder. So this data looked at what it used were Christmas bird count data, used eBird, it used the breeding bird surveys that are across North America. And so... It's really big. And one of the things that we always talk about on this show, we've had people call in before and be like, I don't hear as many of this
right.
as I did in the past. And what I'm always trying to get people to think about is, how can we look at trends? And that's what this did, is it took, I mean, the Christmas bird count has been around for over 100 years. Breeding bird surveys, there's some that are like 25, 30 years old in different parts of the country, if not more. And so we need to look at those trends to kind of figure out how things are going, but then we need to kind of then break them down into these regional areas as well. And I think that's really challenging when we look at some of these numbers. Some of the things that came out in the report, I'm thinking back to the report that we talked about a couple years ago that came from the Vermont Center for Eco Studies, which was the 2017 status of Vermont forest birds. And they had done a quarter century of monitoring of forest birds across Vermont. And some of the birds match up as what we're seeing in this current report that are in decline. But then we have more specific pieces of data about different birds. I was really interested to see that the report in the Science Journal was saying that woodpeckers were doing all right. They were doing better. But in some of our research out of the state of Vermont, we're actually seeing a decline in that species.
What else in Vermont? I mean, so specifically, because if we're looking at these big numbers
right.
that say 3 billion gone, and in Vermont, you know, is there an easy way to say 100,000 gone? Or is it just more, we don't have the numbers that match up in that way to be able to say it exactly like that, but we do know that some populations are in decline.
I think they run parallel to each other, that we can say that, yes, there are birds that are in decline based on the different habitats that they're in. And I know in Vermont, we are in that northern forest block, and we are seeing declines in northern forest birds. Vermont Center for Eco Studies teased it out a little bit more and looked at some different species. There were about, I think, 7 or 8 that were all declining. And then they also started to look at how we can group those different birds based on their behavior and how they behave in the habitat. So they had different forest guild types. And the biggest impact on a type of bird were the aerial insectivores. So,
like who?
Like flycatchers. So if you think of like the eastern phoebe that's in your backyard, there's a whole other suite of flycatchers that exist in our forests here, from great crested flycatcher to the eastern wood peewee. See, I got to go peewee. I got to get the bird calls in here somewhere. To least flycatcher. So those birds that are reliant on insects, we're seeing a greater decline in. So what the Vermont Center Eco Studies could do from this data is kind of tease out the ones that were having a strong decline, no decline, a moderate decline, and kind of break it down and then tease things out and start to look at, you know, how do these birds fit into the landscape? What kind of threads can we pull together that will help us make some decisions on actions? And I think we're seeing that same thing reflected in this report. I think about the wood thrushes that are in decline, some of the other birds that were surprising, I mean, like feeder birds, like common feeder birds, like blue jays, like 1 in 4 less than what we had before. I think white-throated sparrow, there's like 1 in 3. Dark-eyed junco was like a 1 in 3 as well. So one of the things that really hit me hard was the fact that a lot of the work that has started to shift and change in the conservation world has been to let's keep common birds common, and let's really work at keeping birds that are in their core breeding habitat breeding here. And what this report told me was, man, we're not doing it yet. And we need that line to start to come back up again.
Denny says, and Bridget, we knew this one was going to come, and so we can decide how much time we want to spend
on
this.
I'm ready for it. I'm ready, Jane.
Denny writes, one thing that could help with declining bird population is for cat owners to keep control of their pets. Keep them indoors or leash and cable train cats. Cat owners will say it can't be done, but I disagree. Cats kill billions of birds a year, so please, cat owners, control your pets. And the Cornell Lab of Ornithology does estimate that pet cats and feral cats kill an estimated 2.6 billion birds each year. So, you know, we've talked about this before, and talking about indoor versus outdoor cats can threaten to take over an entire bird show, and we won't do that today. But let's talk about it a little bit. I mean, Debbie brings it up.
So I'm ready to, like just say it. I'm a cat owner. I have an indoor cat, Siamese cat. Her name's Gayla. And I think we're at that point in time where we really have to think very long and hard about our personal responsibility. And one of those is as a pet owner. And I'm going to put it out there to dog owners, too. And I'm going to say leashing your dog, especially during the breeding season when you're walking public trails or national parks or places where we do even allow dogs, is really important because of the disruption to those breeding and nesting birds.
So even if your dog is not a cat killer, a bird killer, you might be disrupting the breeding habitat and the nests.
Exactly. Let's think a little bit more about that. This is one of the recommendations that has come out from Cornell. There's like 7 tips as a result of this report, which is what I loved. Like, they weren't all doom and gloom. They were right on top of it. And they were like, here's what's happening. Here's what you can do. And one of the things is to keep cats indoors. They're not only impacting birds, but they're impacting amphibian populations as well. And so it's healthier for your cat, and it's healthier for the wildlife that's out there. I would like to encourage towns as well to start to think about how we have leash laws and things for dogs, and what does that look like for cats now? Because the other challenge comes in when you have cats on other people's property. So if you have bird feeders and things at your house and somebody else's cat is coming onto your property and killing birds that are at your feeder or just nesting naturally in your yard or on your property, that becomes problematic and puts us in a really difficult place with our neighbors. So can we think about different ways maybe to enact some different guidelines and policies that will help us make better decisions about how we care for our pets?
Jake has a question about taking action. Jake says, what are some local, statewide, and national organizations that people can support that can help with data collection, policy shaping, and conservation efforts?
So super. Yay. Good question. Okay, so I started to post some of these on my Facebook page when the first, my Bird Diva Facebook page.
I was going to say, is your Facebook page public? Can anybody find it?
Yes, Bird Diva Facebook page is. So please look for that. So I started to post some different things. A lot of you know about my work with Audubon Vermont. Audubon Vermont has the Forest Bird Initiative. They're working very closely with Forest Parks and Recreation in the state on the foresters for the birds. So we now have foresters trained in how to look at your land in a way that's going to be good for birds, the habitat, and the health of the forest. So you can still manage the way you want to, but you're keeping birds in mind. They also have a great Champlain Valley Initiative that addresses shrub scrubland birds as well as grassland birds. So I would check that out. If you're a smaller landowner, there's a backyard woods course that's through the Vermont Urban and Community Forestry Program that will teach you different ways to manage your backyard in a way that's going to be really good for birds and other wildlife. The Upper Valley Grassland Bird Initiative, which is out of the Vermont Center for Eco Studies. So if, man, and Jane, this was the other one, right? Grassland birds, that suite of birds, and I'm thinking upland sandpiper, bobolink, grasshopper, sparrow, and oh my gosh, my favorite, like eastern meadowlark,
right? I love the meadowlark.
They're so beautiful. That habitat is experiencing across North America, like around a 53% loss in number of birds in this study. And we're seeing that same thing in New England, but even greater. And it's because a lot of our abandoned farms are reverting back to forests. So one of the big questions that I have after all of my work with forest birds is how can we do the same thing? How can we start looking at a landscape scale and assess and protect grasslands across the state as well? And Audubon Vermont and the Vermont Center for Eco Studies are really leading the way on that. You know, you can get a habitat stamp through Vermont Fish and Wildlife. You can get a conservation plate, and all that money goes back into protecting wildlife management areas and putting grants out there that are available for water quality and for wildlife. The other thing is just do citizen science. And that's like, that was one of the tips on the tip sheet. And it literally says, do citizen science. Just do it. Just do it. And there's a number of different ways. I mean, you guys are all probably tired of me talking about eBird, but man, the data that you put into that comes around and it's helping us figure out what's going on the ground here, both locally and now, well, you know, nationally and content wide. Birder Broker is another one, new program.
Now it's Birder Broker.
Oh my gosh, we talked about this in the spring. So we just kicked this off. I teamed up with the Vermont Center for Eco Studies to pair birders with landowners. So if you're a landowner, you're like, oh my gosh, I really want to know more about the birds on my property, but I don't know how to go about it. You can sign up for this program. We'll match you up with a birder. The birder comes out and walks the property either with or without you. It's up to you. 3 times during the breeding season. And what this does is it really helps us gain more data on private lands. And so we get a richer data set. We have a lot of, you know, great data on public lands and places that people can access easily. But landowners, you know, that's your landscape. That's, you own that. And so you get to control who comes on that. And if you would like to invite a birder to come and give you more information about what's there, we can do that through Birder Broker. And you can find that on my website as well as the Vermont Center for Eco Studies website. There's a lot of things to do. And I think the other thing that we have to start to look at, I think about all the personal things that I try to do. I just switched over to carrying cloth bags for my vegetables at the grocery store, right? I already had the grocery bag thing down. But instead of pulling those plastic bags down in the grocery store, I switched to bringing cloth bags. And it sounds silly, but like that plastics thing is a part of this as well. So we're seeing declines in seabirds and shorebirds and things like that that have tons of plastic in their bellies. So there's these little things that we can do ourselves. And then I think we have to start thinking about, if I'm active on the personal level, how am I active on the community level? How can I be more active on the state level? And then push it upwards from there.
And we may get more into some of these as the show goes on, but let's go to Jack, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Jack.
Hello.
Hey.
I have a question and a comment. So my question is there any sort of a push to limit the mass spraying of insecticides? And I know that, you know, politicians are kind of between a rock and a hard place when there's an outbreak of equine encephalopathy. They have to say, we're doing something about this. But what they do is they destroy the whole base of the ecosystem and think nothing of it. And, I mean, my own way of dealing with that would probably be to just try to avoid being outdoors for a couple of weeks at the end of the summer. Or anyway, there's that. And then my other question is, the conservation movement is one of my issues with it, and I'm very much a conservationist. I take a lot of personal measures to try to do what I can for the environment. I've stopped flying. There's a bunch of things that I do. But the conservation movement is so anti-intervention. And, you know, we've monkeyed with this for so long that I think this idea, well, just stand back, don't do anything. I think we should be using molecular biology a lot more to destroy invasive species, like the ash borer. I mean, we're losing just species after species of trees in the Northeast. And so anyway, that's my comment and my question.
Jack, thanks. Okay, so first one is movement to stop insecticides.
Yeah. That's a tough one, right? And I think, you know, I think there is a movement out there to do that. I think it's really hard when we're talking about, growing our own food and the large farm industries. We don't have a lot of that in Vermont. We're really lucky. We have a lot of food that's grown locally and with a lot of care and thought. But it's bigger. It's bigger than that. I don't know if I have an answer about that because I don't know too much about that. And I don't know if there's anybody out there that is involved with how we regulate pesticides that could call in and give their thoughts on that. You know, on a personal level, avoiding pesticides in your yard, that's an easy one. The other one that I start to think about too, that kind of goes along with that, is I was saying, talking about working on the personal level, going then to the local level. I think about how do our towns manage our shared public properties when it comes to mowing, when it comes to pesticide use. I think of wow, the power line right of ways where they use pesticides and different chemicals to control growth and things that are happening along those rights of way for power lines. They have to do that. But do they really? Is there another way to control what they need to control by mowing or different regimes that way?
Or goat pasturing.
Let's put some goats out there. So I start to think about how can we start to ask those questions locally in our own community so we're starting to learn about how we're using those things on the landscape right where we live. And then that might help us inform, you know, moving up in terms of scale.
Well, let's keep talking about this. And Jack also talked about this idea of, you know, could we be doing more to prevent invasive species and to be doing other things? But we're going to sort of weave this into the rest of the conversation. We're talking about some of the bird losses that we're seeing around the North America. We're talking about birds here in Vermont and what we can do to protect them and what we can be thinking about, both in terms of our own yards, our communities, our state, and national policy. And we're just talking about birds that we've seen and haven't seen, birds that we like, birds that we want to see, birds that we like but don't know what they are, like this one from Stephen, who wrote in to say, Bridget, can you tell what kind of bird this is by its song? All I know is it's loud and it's really small, and Stephen recorded the sound, so here it is.
Oh.
All right. So the wind chimes are not a bird.
No. Okay. So you've got, this is what's great about this, right? So this is so interesting. So this is like the soundscape, right? In his yard. Obviously, this is a bird that's right outside his door. Because what I was going to say to you is, I was like, oh, he didn't give us any information about habitat. Like, what's the context here?
No.
But you could hear it in the recording. That's so great. So I'm guessing, because of the wind chimes, that this was like right near his house. Now, it's chattery, right?
Small and loud.
Small, loud. Those are great clues. And it descends. And then there's like that little ch-ch-ch-ch, right? So it got a little bit agitated in there, which is kind of cool too. So this is a wren. So we have house wrens, and we have Carolina wrens, and we have winter wrens, and we have marsh wrens. And they're all these like little tiny brown birds with like these cute little kind of long beak, longer than a like a chickadee in relation to their size. They are about the size of a chickadee. A lot of them have little tails that kind of perk up in the back instead of being held out down low. So this is house wren, which is a common backyard wren. These guys love nest boxes, so you can keep them around by putting some nest boxes out for them. They're loud and they're saucy. They're just so much fun.
Speaking of nests, so BHA says, does Bridget know how far apart tree swallows will nest from one another? I have a birdhouse about 40 feet from a pond, and there are tree swallows in it every year. If I put up another house about 100 feet away, will another pair be allowed in the territory?
Oh my gosh, you have the perfect distance according to the tree swallow project.com online. So I looked this up because I saw your fabulous post.
Cheater.
Online. I know. So yes, 100 feet apart is just right to give them enough, like a little buffer zone. So they don't like that, like condos right on top of each other kind of thing. So
they're Vermonters.
Yeah. 100 feet apart. And you want it to be 100 yards from building because they don't like to be super close to a lot of buildings or development. And oddly, I thought this was really interesting, like 50 yards from the water. So I'm curious. Yeah. So they probably really like to be near the water because there's going to be hatches of insects off of the water surface and the water edge that will be really great for them. But you've got that right. 100 feet apart so that you will be able to provide them enough space for one another so they won't be fighting and duking it out.
Let's go to Jim, who's calling in from West Burke. Jim, hi. Go right ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have a comment and a question and maybe another smaller question at the time. I first moved to Vermont in 1970, and definitely since I moved here, I've been telling people for the last 7 years I haven't been seeing nearly as many birds. And definitely way less insects, especially like June bugs and things like that, which I hardly see anymore. Now, maybe that's because I don't live in the same environment. I've learned from listening to this show that if you live by a field, you're going to see different birds, and I live in the woods now, so maybe that's got something to do with it. My question is, I saw a bird in the spring on the ground that I had never seen before. It was about the size of a pigeon, maybe a little bit bigger, gun gray. Very gray, and it was shredding around with its tail fan out like a turkey. I believe there was some black in the tail, if I remember correctly.
Any thoughts on what that might be, Bridget?
Okay, so about the size of a pigeon. Yes?
Perhaps a little larger.
Yeah, a little bit larger. So grouse do that tail fanning as well. And they're like a gray-brown tone forest bird. You said you live near the forest now, so that's likely as well. So they will have that like splayed-out tail. Short beak, smaller than a turkey, kind of looks like a forest chicken-ish. Yeah, something like that. Does that sound close?
I don't know. It was very gray. That's all that stuck out in my mind, that it was just, when you think of gray, it was just the perfect gray.
Yeah.
Maybe some black in the tail. It was fairly small for a bird that had its tail stuck out like that.
Cool.
I thought storks mate a few days later, but I never saw them again after that.
Hmm. Try ruffed grouse.
Hmm. That's an interesting one, Jim. I appreciate the idea. It's a or the idea conundrum because, yeah, gray doesn't really track very well.
No.
Huh. Well, that's interesting. Elaine is calling in from Fairfax. Elaine, hi.
Hi, Jane. My question has to do with sandhill cranes. Mm. We have a pair of sandhill cranes that are very visible in our area in the spring and the fall, and we live near a lot of open farm fields and right up next to the large Fairfield swamp. My question is, I don't think these birds are common in Vermont. I'd like to know a little bit more about them. Thank you.
Elaine, what a cool sighting. We see them, too, in northern Addison, southern Chittenden County, in the sort of Moncton-Hinesburg area. Sometimes we catch them, and that flash of red, it really sort of...
I know. They're super cool. Prehistoric looking, right? Like, almost even more so than the great blue heron. So, yeah, this is not a common bird to our area. But we do have sets of breeding pairs across Vermont that are now established and raising young every year.
It's so cool.
I know. And if you're in the Fairfield Swamp area, you are seeing this pair that's, gosh, it's got to have been there for more than 5 years now. I would have to look back at some of the eBird reports to see how far back that goes. But that is a pair that returns there every year. They have actually stayed through the winter. Rumor has it in communities up there that they've snuck into people's barns.
Oh,
so
wow.
I had somebody call me and say they had this strange bird in their barn at one point in time. It turned out it was one of the sandhill cranes. So we do have pockets of them across the state. There's actually this weekend, we saw two over the Missisquoi River Delta up in Swanton as well. And they will be moving out as the seasons shift. So not a typical breeder here, but we're starting to see more breeding pairs.
Just describe them really briefly for people who haven't seen them. I know, Bridget,
So tall like a heron.
Yep.
Right? And they're like a tawny brown color. I'm like flipping through my Sibley's guide here so I can be exact. It's really funny how when you ask a birder to describe something, you're like, well, I know it's a crane. And it's because that subconscious part of your brain is like, well, I know what that looks like. I know what that feels like, even though you're not really feeling the bird, if you know what I mean. But you have this idea of what those guys look like. They're crane-like. Sandhill crane is like a blue-gray kind of color. Now I'm looking at my book. Black legs.
See, Bridget has good methods for stalling until she gets to the right page in her Sibley guide.
There's going to be a little bit of a rusty wash where the wings are folded against the body. But then the head is really cool because they've got this long heron-like beak, but then a red cap that comes right down over the forehead and touches the bill. A little bit of white in there as well. And when you see them, you just know it. And they just look dinosaur-like. I will never forget. I was really frustrated because for a number of years, I had gone to the Fairfield Swamp area to see these birds. And every time I drove by, after somebody had reported them, I would not be in the right place at the right time.
That's how I was for a snowy owl for a while.
And I'm driving, my husband and I are driving up to Bakersfield one day, and I'm telling him this story and complaining and whining about it. And he goes, you mean those birds right there as we were passing Fairfield Swamp? And he sees them. And I was like, no, that did not just happen. But it did. I've had the pleasure of seeing them a number of times since then with the babies as well, which is really delightful.
Oh, that I would love to see. So Diane has a question for you. Diane says, we had read that it was good to have water available for birds in the winter, too. Mm. So we bought a bird bath that plugs in. We never saw a bird use it last winter. This year, we put it out at the end of the summer, thinking the birds might need some time to get used to it. We have plenty of birds in the fields around our house and plenty at the bird feeders in the winter. Also, Diane says, we have a concrete bird bath nearby that they do use, but of course, in the winter, it freezes. She says, we also put a rock in the middle for them to land on and some adhesive sandpaper on the side for a landing spot. Still, no birds seem interested. What is the story on birds needing water in the winter? And if so, how can we help?
Can you do this? You know, I admire your persistence.
They can sense your desperation, Diane.
They're like, no, they're not doing this. They keep adding new stuff. Each time you add something new, it takes a while for birds to get used to it, too. So, like, I get really excited when I get new feeders and I put them out. And I'm like, yay, everybody's going to be on it. I filled it up. It's great. And it takes forever for them to really get comfortable.
Unless you're talking about hummingbirds. I mean, I feel like you have barely walked away from your hummingbird feeder and the birds are there.
And they're there. And I just don't. We talked about that this spring. Like, how do they even find it? It's like they're sneaking around neighborhoods just waiting in the bushes for that to pop up. So I think one of the challenges here is in trying to, like, assess what's going on in your yard, what's familiar to the birds, and how do you introduce something new. It may also, like, you're discovering, right, that cement bird feeder, what's the quality in that the birds like? Does it have more of a sloped edge to it? I know some of the heated bird baths are like a pan, almost like a casserole dish or something with the raised sides on them. And so it's not easy for the bird to perch or land or grab onto it. There are some other types of heating elements that you could put in your ceramic bird bath. That's a possibility. The other piece that is really attractive to birds is the dripping water sound. So if you can get a dripper or a mister or something like that, that's a part of that heated feeder where it's gurgling or bubbling a little bit. Sometimes that sound also will attract them. Keep experimenting. I'm so interested to hear that you have a cement bird bath that's working, but this heated one that you've invested in as well. Thank you for doing that. It isn't yet. And I'm just going to say yet because I just don't think they've quite figured it out. And I think water is really important during the wintertime open water sources. I think especially in the spring when we have those late snows, those places where there are natural seeps or natural pools of water pooling on the landscape, those are the spots that a lot of the migrants are going to in order to drink and bathe, in order to maintain their feathers and to maintain their bodies.
Bridget, I'm going to challenge you to do a little bit of a lightning round, a couple quick questions here, and then we'll get back into some more other ones. Steve the Bacon on Twitter says, what about putting a bell on your cat to protect the birds? We talked about cats are big bird killers around the world, a couple billion birds killed by cats. So what about a bell?
Bells don't work, apparently. The bell thing, there's also collars that you can put on cats that supposedly work as well. There has been some research done on a product that I believe is actually out of Vermont. I guess that's a good first step, but I'm going to stake my ground and say we got to start making the shift in keeping cats indoors.
Okay. Anne says, I've let some of my small 2-acre plot go wild.
Yes.
Lots of meadow flowers, but the trees are moving in. Mm-hmm. Should I keep them back? Because we were talking earlier about how grassland, especially that sort of scruffy land, is declining. And Vermont is pretty forested, which is great. But so should Anne make sure that the trees are not moving in?
Yeah. So I'm going to say huzzah, Anne, for letting things like just grow, right? Who really wants to spend summertime mowing lawns? And I got to tell you, I do a lot of traveling across the state. And we've got some pretty big lawns out there. So I'm going to throw out another challenge. I want you to take like maybe just a quarter of what you mow, like, and stop mowing it and see what happens.
What will the neighbors say?
Well, you know, we have to change that perception as well. And I know that in some communities, you will get a citation from your town for not mowing and allowing things to grow. And I think we need to change that as well. This is about creating connected habitats. And as we start to zoom out, we really have to look at things on a landscape scale. We can't be like picking this bird to save and that bird to save and this one. We really have to start to look at habitats across the landscape. So, Anne, here's what I would do. I would do a cosmic zoom on where you live, and I would zoom way out and look at all the different habitats that are around you on a broader scale. How does yours fit into the larger landscape? Are there other fields for forest. So you're talking about young trees coming up in. There's a whole suite of birds that really like that, from indigo buntings to chestnut-sided warblers. So I would find out, how does that type of habitat fit into the broader landscape around you, and make a decision. Do I want to keep it in a grassland mode? Do I want to let it go to like a shrub scrub young forest mode? And then there are different ways that you can manage accordingly. And Audubon Vermont has a really great program to help you do that. So they have a lot of information on their website. You want to look at the Champlain Valley Bird Initiative, because that, even if you're not in that, that's the habitat type that's specific to grassland and shrub scrubland birds.
We failed at the lightning part of that, but that was super interesting. No, super interesting. Rose says, are nest boxes adequate for keeping backyard birds warm and sheltered? Should I invest in roost boxes?
Yes, please. Roost boxes during the wintertime are awesome. These are a little bit different, where the hole is down near the bottom of the front part of the box and not up near the top, because you want all the heat to stay in the top. So just try some roost boxes. I have a great friend on the Richford Conservation Commission. You can reach out to them. They can give you some roosting box plans and tell you all their fabulous stories about winter bird roosting.
Cool.
That was faster, wasn't it?
That was, yeah, well done. All right, let's go to Herb, who's calling in from South Burlington. Hi, Herb.
Hi. Murder mysteries are popular these days. And I have a mystery that I wonder if you could shed light on. I came out yesterday morning, and on a log near my house, where a couple of squirrels always hang out and seem to be feeding on vegetation nearby, there was a pile of feathers, and they were mostly downy feathers, but they were, and they were all white, very small and white, and there were a few brownish tinged feathers around, and there was just the entrails of something that had been obviously killed there. There's almost no, I never see any fox or any kind of wild predators. There's almost no cats around the neighborhood or anything like that. And I'm wondering, because I actually saw a hawk take a gray squirrel before, I'm wondering if that could have been, if the feathers could have been from a predator that had taken a squirrel, or if that might be a bird that something else took. And I just wondered if you have any ideas on what that might have been.
Yeah. Okay. So you're telling the story. I'm like so excited because I love these like murder mystery stories. And oddly, even though I live in St. Albans City, we're having a lot of them. And the reason why we have a lot of them in our neighborhood is because we have a Merlin and a Cooper's Hawk that are hanging out. So
I'm murderers
in my neighborhood. But welcome, murderers. They provide us with these great stories on the land. So I like the fact that you were thinking that maybe like the squirrel was like fighting back and kicking off feathers from like the hawk. I think that's a fascinating kind of theory. At the same time, if there's like a lot of feathers, then it's not likely that it was from the squirrel kicking the raptor. However, that raptor might have a spot that it likes to come back to over and over again, especially to kind of process their prey. One of the cool books that you can get is Bird Tracks and Signs. I believe it's by Mark Elbrock. And what's great is when in talking about raptors, you can look at how a raptor chooses to feed, whether it feeds up in the tree and stuff is cascading down. Like in my backyard a couple years ago, we had a great horned owl take out a crow. And there were feathers and blood that had cascaded down all over the snow in the backyard. Our Cooper's Hawk, when it takes something, it sits on the prey and it plucks the feathers out. So it comes out in like an arc shape. So there's almost like a circle of feathers with a blank space in the middle where the bird has pulled everything out in order to get at the insides. On a recent program with a bunch of teachers, we found a spot that had two bird sternums and an owl skull and what looked like owl feathers as well, but like multiple kills processed on this one log. And it just turned into this great discussion with some trackers that I've connected with on Facebook through the New England tracking group that's on there. And we just talked about different types of birds that might do that and different types of mammals that like to take their kill to the same spot. And a mammal will process a kill very different than a bird. And I'm going to leave it there because we could talk forever about that stuff.
I have a log like that, too, deep in the woods in New Haven that my kids and I go to because there's always something there. We found an owl pellet there once, which this is not necessarily a kill site. We found a dead duck there once. Lots of feathers and the duck head, bone, bones, and the beak was really cool. And then we found some eggs and a ground nest there, and so we started leaving it alone for the rest of the summer. But it's a fascinating spot. There's always something happening in this one spot that we just come back to every weekend or every other weekend to see, you know, what's new in our little area here down by the river, deep in the woods.
Now, imagine if you set up a game camera there.
I know.
It would be very cool. You would capture those stories that you don't see, but then do you really want to know?
Next spring, we'll do that. All right, so we're running short on time, but Bridget, I teased this, and you've teased this. So what's the deal with the white pelican on Lake Champlain?
Yes. Okay, so this was like the big buzz this summer, right? So in July, Terry Marin, who's the coordinator for the island's Christmas bird count, she had someone who was staying in a cottage near her mention this big giant bird that was out near Knight Island. And it turns out it was an American white pelican. Now, these things are huge, Jane. Like they're bigger than eagles big. They're like the biggest, chunkiest flying bird. Like they're one of the heaviest flying birds out there. So when you see them, it stands out so much. And it's snow white. And it just got people really excited. Normally, this bird is in the interior of North America, both in Canada and in the United States. It likes those interior lakes and water bodies. And this one got blown off course or just was like, yeah, I'm going for a visit somewhere else. And they have
showed up. Who doesn't like to summer in Vermont?
I know. It's beautiful in Vermont. And the bird disappeared for a while, and then it popped up a little bit further north. I saw it with a group of people up at the Tyler place in the air flying. And I was like, that thing is huge and white, and it's got that giant orange beak. Like, it couldn't have been anything else. And then it hung out for a while at Campbell Bay up near the west branch of where the Missisquoi River comes out into Lake Champlain. It's disappeared since, but it was a big talking point and kind of like a draw for a lot of birders to come and visit some different spots up north and experience this really strange, funky-looking bird. I'm sure if you Google White Pelican Vermont, you'll come up with a bunch of pictures online. It's really super cool to see. And again, another example of when our sightings come into play to understand how birds are moving and shifting across the landscape.
Bridget, before I let you go, I want to, you know, we have so much fun, and I know so many listeners are really interested and excited about birds and really interested in preserving them. But, you know, it's like all this stuff is happening. It's hard to know what to care about. It's hard to care about everything. It's hard to maintain your concern for everything because you can just be exhausted. So do you have any just advice to leave us with as we think about bird loss and habitat and ecosystem collapse?
I got overwhelmed in putting all my notes together this morning. And I think about this report came out the same time as the climate strikes were happening. And I think birds are a great avenue for action. And that avenue hits along all these things that we're struggling with when it comes to what's happening with the environment right now, with climate change, with water quality, with habitat loss. And I think if you use that as your inspiration and your guide, and maybe it's not birds, maybe it's mammals or something else, but birds are just this really nice, inspiring vehicle to action. And I want to encourage everybody, you know, this report is overwhelming, but there's still time. We still can pull things back. It's not all doom and gloom or over with. So just, you know, up the ante. Do just a little bit more in this next year. And let's keep reporting birds that we see out on the landscape and staying positive.
That's Bridget Butler, known around these parts as the Bird Diva. She's also a birding consultant, so she can help you figure out how to fix your landscape up for birds, conserve habitat, or just lead a bird walk in your area. We have a link at vpr.org. Also, go to vpr.org to learn how to get tickets to But Why Live. Bridget will be in that, along with Michael Clough from the Southern Vermont Natural History Museum, who will be bringing live birds. It's in November. Great show for all ages. Great for your kiddos. Bridget, thanks as always for being part of the show today.
Thank you, Jane.
I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.